On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, I would like to turn the call over now to Ms. Annie Beigel.
Oh, thank you, Elizabeth. And good afternoon, everyone. I'm Annie Beigel, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health and Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I'd like to welcome you to today's conference call, Your Patients and Smokeless Tobacco Products, and our featured and distinguished speaker, Dr. Peter Shields, Professor of Medicine and Oncology, Georgetown University, and Deputy Director of the Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center. So just a quick reminder to everyone that due to New York's very high excise tax on tobacco products, many of your patients are very motivated to quit. So now more than ever is a good time to talk with them and help them to quit. And as the research tells us that when you assist your patients to quit tobacco use, they are twice as likely to succeed. And many of you have been asking our cessation centers about the use of smokeless tobacco products such as e-cigarettes and snus. So for today's call, we wanted to provide you with the latest research on these products, discuss the associated health risks, and how you can help your patients. Now, there's considerable debate regarding these products, but our goal today is not to engage in any debate, but rather to provide you with information on what we know, what we don't know, and what we need to know about these products so that you can better serve your patients. And we are pleased to offer continuing education hours, including CME, CEU, OASAS clock hours, and CRCE. So to fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we're required to disclose the following. Dr. Shields has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor does he have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. So to obtain the continuing education credit for today, you need to follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website. And please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after September 10th. That's a week from this Friday, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. And now it's my pleasure to hand the call over to Dr. Peter Shields. Dr. Shields?
Hi. Okay, so hello, everyone. Hopefully you have the handout, the PDF of slides, one per page, and as I advance, I will let you know when I'm advancing to a slide, as well as hopefully remember that to give you the number of that slide. So the first one is the introduction. That's not me on either horse. The next slide, two, is about the disclosure, which was just meant, so we're just going to plow through to slide three. And what I'm going to be talking about is four general topics. The first is on our jargon for harm reduction related to tobacco-related diseases, and I'll explain what harm reduction is. Then we will talk about smokeless tobacco and its risks, and a new product that's gaining some attention here in the United States that's a smokeless tobacco product called snus. Then we'll talk a little bit about electronic cigarettes, or e-cigs, and then we'll talk about some ways to help people quit using smokeless tobacco. So the first thing I just want to point out, which may be on everyone's radar screen, but really remarkably last year, Congress signed into law giving the Food and Drug Administration the authority to regulate tobacco products. And this is the initials of the FSPTC, which is the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act. And it really gives the FDA, in many ways, remarkable powers to change the landscape for tobacco control. And it's up to us, of course, to help the FDA be successful and to implement their recommendations. But I just wanted to give you a couple of parts of this act. One of the sections actually says that for a tobacco company to introduce a new product that has not been marketed before February 2007, they actually have to apply to the FDA for permission. And they have to give, with it, studies on the health risk of that product. So suppose they have a new cigarette, for example. They have to test it some way and give information about health risk. They have to fully disclose the ingredients and additives with a description of manufacturing methods. And that's to the FDA. So it'll all be confidential and proprietary, but at least someone now, other than tobacco companies, will be looking at what is in these products. And they have to talk about their packaging and labeling. And this is really remarkable if you think about it. I mean, some of you are probably scratching your heads, like, why do you even need studies on health risk for products? But in fact, there's some of the products I'll be mentioning have new and different health claims. And so by law, they're entitled to be able to introduce these products and make claims if the FDA approves. And what I find remarkable as part of this act is that it's actually clear to the FDA that once they get an application from a tobacco manufacturer that within 180 days, the FDA has to say either okay or it's not okay. And also as remarkable is that if it's not okay, what they need to fix, so the bar will be set. And I'm sure if the bar is considered by the tobacco companies way too high, the FDA will be sued and the courts will decide whether that bar is too high. There's another, the next slide, five, another part of that Tobacco Control Act actually specifically looks at these modified risk tobacco products. And that's different because that's going to be, for example, the snus products or the e-cigarette products where they want to be able to say this causes less disease risk than a cigarette. And tobacco manufacturers believe that if they can make those claims, they'll get more of their products being sold. And so as part of that, not only do they have to give the studies to support their claim, but also included in it is that they have to give the study, they have to show studies about what the consumer will think about these products and what will be the impact. For example, if the consumer thinks they now have a safe product, will they just switch to this and not quit all tobacco? Will they switch to this and for a period of time then go back to smoking when they might have quit otherwise? And so there's a lot of scenarios, which I'll talk about, that the FDA will be able to look at and decide whether or not this product can be harmful in many ways beyond just the actual product, but what it might do to tobacco control overall. So the next slide, just your information, other parts of this act requires that within 36 months, the FDA has to come up with how these products should be tested. And that's not a trivial thing. I mean, we all think that tobacco's been around for so long, and there's all sorts of laboratory studies that could be done for tobacco and human studies. But really, it has not been particularly well studied because the health risks have been so obvious. It's really been an unfunded area within research. And so a lot of us are scratching our heads about what's the best way to show that one product is more toxic than another, for example, as opposed to whether the product is toxic or not toxic, because that's now on the radar screen of tobacco companies and the FDA. But part of it also requires the FDA to consider fast-tracking cessation products and considered extended use nicotine replacement therapy. And in fact, there's a conference being organized by FDA next month on what evidence is there about, you know, long-term uses of nicotine replacement therapy, for example, someone who might use it for years so that they stay quit or they smoke less. Our packages will change. 50% of the packages are going to include very graphic images. And the interesting thing is that all of this at the FDA is going to be funded by user fees, meaning the tobacco industry. So as they make their applications, they'll get assessed dollars. And within 10 years, it's considered to be or will be the largest part of the FDA. They have different centers, and so the Tobacco Control Center will be the largest, bigger than medications and devices and food and everything else. So that's, I think, pretty interesting. So let me talk about harm reduction. So the concept is that even if you're going to continue a risky behavior, can you reduce those risks without stopping them entirely? And the analogy is seatbelts. So even though we all want to drive in a car, driving at 60 miles an hour is more dangerous than 20 miles an hour, but with a seatbelt, you have less deaths. So that is considered a harm reduction method for driving. One of the problems, though, is that there are some people who will put on their seatbelt and then drive faster because they think they're safer. Okay. So inherent in the assessment of harm reduction is what's happening to all individuals and what's happening to the population overall. Now, for smoking, it's there's different ways to potentially achieve harm reduction. And what I want to remind everyone is that while today we talk about harm reduction in, you know, related to smoking, there's no proven harm reduction method, with one exception, and that's quitting and staying quit forever. Then we know that for sure, you know, disease risk goes down compared to someone who would be continued smoking. But there is lots of theoretical ways now that maybe we could do that for smokers who just absolutely won't quit or can't quit. And we all know that there are a lot of a lot of people who just, no matter how hard they try, they just can't quit. So could there be a different alternative for them? And so, as I mentioned, the tobacco companies are coming out with new devices that they consider are reduced exposure products. Smokeless tobacco, there's a lot of controversy right now and a lot of heated debates about If you get someone to switch from smoking to smokeless tobacco, isn't that a harm reduction method and a good thing? And the nicotine replacement therapy. Maybe some people could wear a patch and instead of smoking a pack a day, could smoke a half a pack a day, get less cigarettes, and then at least conceptually have a lower risk because they're getting lower exposure. So our problem with the harm reduction for tobacco and what this figure 7 shows is that we've kind of put the harm reduction paradigm into different boxes. Of course, they're not really boxes, it's a continuum. But we talk about exposure reduction, risk reduction for the individual, and then harm reduction for the population. It is possible today to do blood and urine testing to see whether or not someone has less exposure to cigarettes. For example, you can do a cotinine level in the serum or urine or some fancy marker for different carcinogens. And we could do that today. But we don't know whether or not you reduce a specific biomarker like cotinine by 50%. As someone goes forward, are they going to reduce their cancer risk? So two examples, if someone is 60 years old and they drop their cotinine level by 50%, does that mean that they're less likely to get lung cancer at 65? Kind of hard to believe. But if there's someone who at the age of 20 drops their smoking and their cotinine levels by 50%, going forward, dose-response relationships would say that they might have less of a lung cancer risk at the age of 65. So the problem is that we don't know today how to interpret exposure reduction. How much reduction in a blood test, for example, is enough to actually translate into measurably reduced risk. And so that's why we separate out risk reduction for individuals, because we don't really have those markers. And if you think about it, when our patients come to us who are smokers, or smokeless tobacco users, you don't have a blood test to see who's more likely or less likely to get cancer. I mean, I think that that's pretty remarkable. So we have a big gap between that exposure reduction and risk reduction. And until we really know that exposure reduction translates to risk reduction, as we counsel patients and as the FDA decides about what labeling to use for different products, the question is how sure are you that this is actually going to translate into something meaningful, and the FDA will actually have to evaluate the data and come up with specific determinations. And then we have even one more layer of complication, which is what happens to the population. So suppose there is a product out there that is clearly exposure reducing and risk reducing. But in fact, what also happens is that where someone who might have quit smoking entirely, they now start using these products, so they have some risk that's higher than if they quit entirely. Or even worse, a former smoker who's now done as good as they can do to reduce their risk sees this product and says, I'm going to start using this product, and now they've increased their risk. And so we actually have reversal in tobacco control with theoretically more people using tobacco products and more people getting tobacco-related disease, so the net effect of the harm to the population is increased. So these are incredibly complex scenarios that really need to be thought through carefully. And there are a bunch of us who are, and the FDA who is now required to. So the next slide, slide 8, really challenges sort of a fundamental theory here, which is, shouldn't any exposure in risk reduction ought to be better? Okay, it makes sense. Less exposure, less things. So why not allow the tobacco companies to go ahead and market any of these products? Okay, so there's a couple of reasons why less may not be better. If you go to the next slide, number 9, okay, is that, you know, we all know that the more you smoke, the higher you have, for example, for cancer risk, heart disease risk, whatever. The question is if you, after a period of time smoking, you then reduce your cigarette smoking, how much do you have to reduce to actually see a measurable benefit? So complete cessation, you can clearly slide back on that dose response curve. But with smoking reduction or even switching to smokeless tobacco, you don't know where you're going to be on that reverse curve sliding down. And if even though it ought to be better, if you can't show it's better, then we can't really recommend to our patients to do it. I mean, you certainly wouldn't recommend a medication to a patient because you thought it ought to be better for them. Rather, you're going to want to look at or know that there's actually scientific data to support that. So that's one thing. And the second thing is what about that harm reduction paradigm? Because if something ought to be better but is not really better, A, is it okay to misinform people? But B, what about those former smokers or people who might have quit and now they're back on tobacco products? So while maybe it ought to be better, you're actually getting something worse. So again, this is a very complicated scenario, and later when I talk about the light cigarettes for a couple of minutes, I'll give you a specific example of where harm reduction really failed. So the next slide, number 10, is examples of products that have been introduced on the market. And actually, 3 years ago, this area was really taking off. And as it turns out, every one of these products, with the exception of the snus on the top right, has been taken off the market. And the problem is that as the tobacco companies try to make a cigarette-like device that's like cigarettes, the further they get away from, for example, a regular Marlboro or Marlboro Light, the less appealing it is to the consumer, and they don't use it. And then, of course, the closer they get to a Marlboro or a Marlboro Light, the less harm reduction they're going to have. And so they really have not gotten the consumers to accept these products, but they have been putting in a tremendous amount of money. Now, most recently, the shift has gone more towards snus-like products, which I'll mention, because they really haven't been successful in the cigarette products. But to give you some examples of what has been on the market, there's the Accord product on the top left, which is a cigarette that goes in this little electronic device. And it heats the tobacco with electricity, so you don't get the burning from a fire. You get less paralysis. And what comes out of this cigarette, at least on a smoking machine, is much less of the pyrolysis products, which are the, you know, the bad actors that cause disease, like the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and the tobacco-specific nitrosamines, even carbon monoxide and that sort of thing. And this is an interesting product because it actually regulates how much you inhale and only so many puffs per cigarette. But the consumers just didn't like it, just didn't have the right taste. So this is an ad that I think came from, well, all of these ads have been in either Rolling Stone magazine, Time magazine, magazines that, you know, that are actually have quite a big readership. The next product is Eclipse, the one that says get free coupons. That's a product that also works on this concept of heating tobacco rather than burning, and what it has is it's got this coal element on the tip that gets really hot, and it heats the tobacco behind it. On a smoking machine, the data looks great. When you actually give this product to people, because it's so hard to inhale, they suck on it really hard. They take many puffs. They actually turn it into like a regular cigarette. And there was a recent court case that was just won in Vermont, brought forward by the Attorney General's, suing R.J. Reynolds over the Eclipse product and their false advertising, because R.J. Reynolds was advertising that this product may reduce your chances of heart disease and lung cancer and, actually not heart disease, lung cancer and several respiratory diseases. But they didn't have the scientific data to prove it. So then down at the bottom is Omni, which you can see a very explicit ad here. Reduce carcinogens, premium taste. Not that I guess a lot of people really know what carcinogens are, but nonetheless, it certainly sounds like a safer cigarette. This just modified the filter, as did the Marlboro Ultra Smooth to its right, but the consumers just didn't like the taste, so this finally came off. And then I'll talk a lot about the top right, the snus product, and I'll come back to it. So let's hold off for now. So let's start talking about smokeless tobacco with slide 11. And, you know, to some people, there's not that many smokeless tobacco users. I guess it depends on where you are on a relative scale. But there are more than 7.5 million Americans who are using smokeless tobacco at any time. It's about 3.3% of adults overall. Obviously, much more men than women. More common in American Indian Alaska Natives. About 4.3% of whites, less common among Hispanics and African Americans and Asian Americans. But the profile of the people who are usually using it are people who are younger, under the age of 25, and you can see that overall then you get a larger percentage of high school males that are using this. So the next slide, 12, talks about different types of smokeless tobacco, and there are different types. Some of it is finely ground, some of it is more moist. The more finely ground snuff types are things that you just take a pinch and you just put it in your mouth and it just sits there. And then chewing tobacco, which is much more common, is obviously chewed and spit. And then when we talk about spit tobacco, that's something that particularly draws the saliva out of your mouth, or into your mouth rather, and causes you to spit much more, so they have to spit out that as well as the tobacco. So first of all, under slide 13, let me be very clear that as we sit here today, there's still the consensus that smokeless tobacco is harmful for you. In addition to being addictive, they're still considered sufficient evidence. For example, here evaluated by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, that there's sufficient evidence in humans for carcinogenicity as well as in animals. And so it gets the highest IARC rating that one can have. So when you talk about products today, you still have to say that, yes, it does cause cancer. What's in smokeless tobacco? Why is it? Well, smokeless tobacco contains over 28 known probable possible carcinogens, and I'm giving you a list here. But as people are starting to ask more and more about, compared to cigarettes, cigarette smoke, this is much less. Cigarette smoke has about 60 or more known probable possible carcinogens because of all the pyrolysis. You get many more chemicals. Okay, so conceptually, smokeless tobacco is a reduced risk product compared to smoking, if that's what you're using exclusively, and that's what you've done all your life. So if you compare an exclusive smokeless tobacco user to an exclusive smoking user, yes, the smokeless tobacco user will have less risk. What we don't know about is those people who want to switch, whether their risk will go down or in some ways still promote cancer. Smokeless tobacco products, you should realize, that are sold actually have widely varying levels of nicotine. And so there are some products, and that are more typically the starter products like Skull Bandits, that have much less nicotine. And when you get into the higher nicotine products, having about 2 cans a week, which is not uncommon, is equivalent to about the nicotine of about 1.5 packs per cigarette per day. So the next slide is showing you all the different products that are out on the market. Well, there may be more at this point. And you have probably seen ads for snus and maybe getting questions for it now. And so one of the things you'll notice is that we have Marlboro snus and Camel snus. So here are these two big tobacco companies who make all their money from cigarettes who are putting their best name on these products as well as a lot of money in marketing and research. You could see some of the advertising to the left. I won't comment to it, but you can see how what they're targeting here in terms of a cute, sexy product. And they advertise it officially as use this in places where you can't smoke, in a plane, on your motorcycle, playing basketball, after sex, things like that. And so there is some traction to that. But, of course, other people quickly realize, and it's all over the Internet, that maybe this could help you quit. Maybe this could help you smoke less. What a lot of tobacco control people are worried about is that our smoke-free laws that get people to smoke less cigarettes per day keeps them smoking less cigarettes per day. Their nicotine thermostat, so to speak, stays a little bit lower. But if now you can start using snus in bars or at work, maybe when you get closer to a place that you're allowed to smoke, you start smoking more cigarettes because you're still that much more nicotine dependent. That's one of the research questions. Why is it that these snus products are different? Well, there's a couple of reasons that I'll mention. One of them is that they're manufactured differently. And so they come from Sweden, and that's where they got the word snus, because that's just the Swedish word for snuff. And they're manufactured differently, so they have lower levels of specific types of tobacco-specific carcinogens. And the other thing is that they are sold in these little packets that you can see on the top right. So these are tiny little packets that are like tea bags that can fit between your gum and your teeth, and you can get your nicotine absorbed that way. So it's cleaner. You just take that out, just spit it out like a piece of gum. It stays in for about 20 minutes. And so what the tobacco companies are hoping is that they can get people to say, you know, smokeless tobacco is not just for other people who are not like me. But this looks pretty cool, and I'll try it now. So why is there some traction even among tobacco control folks who are saying that snus might be an alternative to smoking? And that is because in Sweden, you look at a number of different statistics. So Sweden has a very high level of snus use. So about 12% of them are exclusive snus users, and or at least men are. And then a large number of them are actual dual users. And what's considered in Sweden is the reason, or that this results in a very low rate of smoking compared to other industrialized countries. And it's true, and they are several percent lower in smoking than we have here. Sweden happens to be the only country in the European Union that allows any sort of smokeless tobacco product Everywhere else it's banned, and there's actually a movement there to allow snus being sold in multiple countries. But the thing about the snus is that because of the way they're curing it, they get a lot less of the tobacco-specific nitrosamines. And I'll give you one example, but the bottom line is that there are many Swedes and several Swedish studies who say that the snus does not even give you a risk of oral tobacco, of oral cavity cancer. So because of this reduced carcinogen. And I have to say that the studies in Sweden overall are only mediocre, but they're all fairly consistent. And most of us believe that if they did the good studies, maybe they would find that this is a reduced product compared to the conventional products sold here. The next slide, 17. But, you know, as we sit here today, what's the sort of official recommendations in the United States? And they're kind of old, okay? So the 86 Surgeon General saying that it's not a safe substitute for smoking cigarettes. 91, when the National Cancer Institute recommended stopping use of all ST. And those are the ones that are still, you know, pretty much out there. But the question is, and don't take my third bullet as the consensus, but I wonder whether there is a developing consensus that smokeless tobacco is an alternative to smoking for smokers who cannot or will not quit. And that's mostly my personal observations from talking to people who, you know, 3 or 4 years ago were just, you know, saying that this is absolutely the wrong road to go down, and there's no way that this is going to be safe enough that anyone would ever recommend it. And still, as I'll show you, for even snus, I don't think you could say that it's safe. So if you look at just oral pharyngeal cancer risk, and I'm on slide 18 now, in general, and smokeless tobacco versus cigarettes. So you can see from a review from 2004 on the left that the oral pharyngeal cancer risk really depends on the product and to some extent the site within the mouth. I mean, the patient doesn't really care what site they get in the mouth. They either get cancer or they don't. But there is some variation where it shows that the dry stuff is worse. And for oral cavity cancer in the pharynx and larynx, it's higher than in other sites. Okay, and that risk, though, you can note from the compared to the risk that are presented for cigarettes on the right from a different review, tend to be lower than what's for cigarettes and oral pharyngeal cancer risk. And again, that's probably because of the difference in pyrolysis. You don't get that for smokeless tobacco. So the next slide is slide 19. And now I'm moving you to Sweden and showing you sort of similar data. So this is a cohort study which collected snus data as well as smoking data, not as good as it could have, but many years ago. And it's and what you can see here is this is just a slide for snus use. And there, for snus users, either current users or ex-users, or depending on how much they use per day, there's really no increased risk of oral cavity cancer in Sweden. So the relative risk, you know, as a reference group of 1, current users is 0.9, and even greater than 10 grams a day is still at 0.9. Lung cancer, not surprisingly, because they're not inhaling anything, is not statistically increased. Although, one of the things that's been noticed in several different types of smokeless tobacco is that pancreatic cancer risk is increased, and that seems to stay true for snus, at least in this study. So the risk of pancreatic cancer is 2.1, which is statistically significant. So I think, you know, it would be wrong for someone to say today that snus is definitely a safe product, because we certainly have studies that indicate that about pancreatic cancer not being true. But just to compare this, so you have a 2-point-fold risk of pancreatic cancer here, not an increased risk for lung or oral cancer, and in the same cohort they did the study for smoking, and you can see there that the pancreatic cancer risk was 3.5 versus 2.1, so still higher than the snus. Of course, lung cancer had a 10-fold risk, no surprise, and the oral cavity cancer came as 2.5 versus the snus, which wasn't increased. So there are some advocates as well as tobacco companies who look at this type of data and say, well, the answer to all our cigarette smoking problems is to get us on smokeless tobacco. And as I said, there's, as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of issues with that, that we have to be careful not to jump to that, and I'm sure the FDA won't be jumping to that. I'm going to actually skip over the next slide, 21, and just go to slide 22. So this is an interesting study from Dorothy Hatsukami and Steve Hecht and co-workers here in the U.S., in Minnesota, actually, at the University of Minneapolis. And they took 73 smokeless tobacco users, and they switched them to either the Swedish snus brands, they switched them to one of the U.S. snus brands, or nicotine patches. And then in the next slide, number 23, They did a number of measures, but here they're measuring the exposure to one of the tobacco-specific nitrosamines, which are the chemicals that are supposed to be reducing snus, and which some people say is the reason why you get a reduced oral cavity cancer risk. And in fact, what they show is that compared to their conventional U.S. brand, when they switch to snus, they drop their tobacco-specific nitrosamines from 3 to almost 1.5. So it's reduced, which is statistically significant, over from 2 to 4 weeks. But of course, if they quit entirely, their levels go down much more. Okay. So when you're talking about people conceptually switching to snus because of lower-risk product, clearly, at least from this data, an exposure to tobacco-specific nitrosamines, quitting is still much better. So I want to digress for one or two minutes and just talk about, because I'm sure you're still thinking now, why isn't less ought to be better? You know, if they're going to stay smoking, why not just go to smokeless tobacco? And I just want to remind everyone about the problems we had with light cigarettes. So when light cigarettes came out and smoking machines were telling people that there was lower tar yields and tar is bad and tar in the back of animals causes cancer, so lower tar must be a safer product. And the tobacco company started advertising this with either implicit or explicit advertising like this. It wasn't until 20 or 30 years later that we realized that there was a problem with all of that. And if you go to the next slide, even the Surgeon General was saying in the 1980s, if you can't switch to you can't quit, switch to lights, just don't compensate. And that made sense at the time. And it was helped by data, like, for example, on the left, which was looking at a cohort study showing that if you smoke a low versus a medium versus a high tar cigarette, you had a higher lung cancer risk with a higher tar. So everyone thought that, okay, this was a reduced product, we'd rather have them quit. But it wasn't subsequently till we really realized that what was happening was that, and this is something the tobacco companies knew almost instantly when they were watching their sales for cigarettes, was that when people were switching to a higher tar to a lower, I'm sorry, from a higher nicotine to a lower nicotine cigarette, they would just compensate because they would still be looking for the same nicotine level in their blood. So they'd smoke more cigarettes per day, or they would smoke more of their cigarettes, or they would do something to, they do one of those two things to compensate. And so it wasn't until really, the late 90s, the early 2000s, that people started going back to this data and really thinking this through. And the data on the right comes from a National Cancer Institute monograph, number 13, where they went back and reanalyzed it, and they realized that the interpretation from the data on the left was just all wrong. And really what was happening on the left is that, they were asking people what they were smoking in the 60s, and then they looked to see who got lung cancer in the 80s. Okay? And if you think about it, in the 1960s, who were those people who were switching to the low-tar cigarettes back then, but people who were more health conscious and more likely to quit, have better diets, be healthier in general? Whereas those with the higher tar cigarettes back in the 60s, it would be the opposite. And in fact, when they went back and reanalyzed the data, which is what's shown on the right, is that those low-tar cigarette smokers in the 60s were actually more likely to be quitters by the time it got to be the 80s. And the high-tar smokers were more likely to become light smokers and still getting their lung cancer. So really what was on the left was just a marker of smoking cessation as opposed to what cigarette that you smoked. And the bottom right one, when they adjusted and made it level for compensation and not quitting and cigarettes smoked per day, basically the risk never changed. And so the recommendation that if you can't quit, switch to lights was basically totally debunked as something worthwhile doing. And so we can imagine different scenarios for smokeless tobacco to happen the same way, as I was mentioning earlier. So now let me switch to slide 26 and talk about the e-cigs. And so you might have heard about them. They're being sold now in many different places. There's a lot of controversy. The FDA has moved to block the import of these cigarettes because they basically said they're nicotine delivery devices and should be regulated by them. And this is hung up in the courts. One of the lower courts said, FDA, no, you're overstepping your bounds, and now it's all up on appeal. But let me go to the next slide, which is number 27. And this is from one of the websites. And I'm paraphrasing the discussion here of benefits, and they're saying that these e-cigarettes lack known carcinogens and poisons and known smoke, no combustion. They contain ingredients found in food and beauty products. They have the same amount of tobacco-specific nitrosamines as nicotine replacement therapy, which is kind of interesting, and I'll come back to that. But lacks tar, lacks CO, and it explicitly says that lacks CO that causes windedness during sex. I'm interested to know what studies they did to support that. But at any rate, and they say it's cheaper than cigarettes, and there's no hot ash to cause fires. So on slide 28, you can see there's many different brands. All of these you can buy off the Internet. The next slide starts to introduce you to what these electronic cigarettes are, and this is from one of the companies where they say that electronic cigarette uses advanced microelectronic technology and supercritical physical atomization technology to atomize the high purity and exciting nicotine dilution extracted from tobacco into smoke for smokers sucking and accordingly meet the needs for those smokers. So basically it is nicotine and propylene glycol that gets vaporized so that people can inhale. Slide 30 gives you the schematic of what these are, but basically there's a battery, there's nicotine in a cartridge that's containing propylene glycol. They put flavorings in, and there's a lot of different flavors. And basically with the battery and electronically, they heat the propylene glycol enough so that it vaporizes so that you can inhale it. As I mentioned, there's a lot of different flavors. And on the end of it, to make it look like a cigarette more so, they put just an LED light. Some of them are red, some of them are blue, which don't get hot. And if you look at some of the videos online, they're actually pretty funny, and I've replicated this for other people, because you could pretend you could smoke the thing and then turn it around to put the light on your face where people expect you to be burned and there's no heat at all. One of the things just to keep in mind on slide 31 is that a lot of these are refillable, and right now they're selling them, the nicotine in the propylene glycol in these little tubes that are not child safety proof, and there's a fair amount of nicotine, and so a lot of people are worried that that packaging needs to change. So, you know, what about these things? Is less ought to be better? Are these things, as there are a lot of people who are strong proponents of these now, if any smokers will switch to them, isn't that better? Well, you know, if anyone switches to any nicotine replacement therapy, we generally think that it's better as long as it helps them to quit. Does this help them to quit? We don't know. Are there other toxins in here because of the manufacturing process? We don't know. Right now, these are totally escaping FDA regulation. We're scratching our heads because this is really a nicotine delivery device, and you know, why does pharmaceutical companies have to go through what they have to go through to the FDA to prove that their NRT, their patches, their gums, their inhalers are manufactured as intended, are as safe as possible, but these companies don't have to do that. And so presumably eventually the FDA will get control, but because these companies say that this is nicotine extracted from tobacco or that these are cigarette-like, we shouldn't have to go through the same requirements. And hopefully the courts will eventually realize that this is just a nicotine delivery device that needs to be regulated the same way. And in fact, if this helps more people to quit, that would be great. But like nicotine replacement therapy, they need to go through their testing. The FDA actually did some pilot studies of this project. I'm on slide 33 now. And I'll just skip ahead to slide 34 to say what they actually found. And that is actually, and we've done our own testing for this too, and I'll show you some other data. But basically, while these companies are saying that these are nicotine delivery devices, actually, at least for the few products tested, the nicotine doesn't get out of the products very much. So what their claims are not supported, and whether that's a quality control issue or whatever, you know, we don't know. They did find some carcinogens, the TSNAs, the tobacco-specific nitrosamines, but you actually also find that at really trace levels in nicotine replacement therapy. And one of the cartridges, they actually found diethylene glycol, which is like an antifreeze, and that probably was a contaminant because there was something else made in the factory that's not supposed to be in the cigarettes, but got into these mixtures. I mean, I'm speculating, but nonetheless, if this was under FDA regulation, that wouldn't be in there. I'm going to skip over to slide 36 just to point out that what the FDA did, and they made very clear, was just some pilot preliminary testing, just enough of it to let the rest of us know a little bit about what's in these products. But it was really very limited stuff, and you can't make much conclusions other than that this should probably be FDA regulated. 37, there are some data about these products. One of them is a report that was circulated via the web, funded by one of the private companies, which basically says that there's no carcinogens in here, with a few exceptions, and those are at very, very low amounts. You know, this hasn't been replicated by others yet, but others are working on it. One of the points I want to highlight about 38, on slide 38, is that the main ingredient is propylene glycol, which these e-cigarette manufacturers like to say, this is the same thing in fog machines. People inhale this stuff all the time. It's a safe product. It's in cosmetics. It's in foods. And all of that might be true, but we really don't know what it's like to heat this stuff and inhale it directly, especially, you know, with multiple puffs, multiple cigarettes per day. And that's really a question that people need to think through in terms about the potential respiratory disease of these products. And I don't think that they should just be able to say it's like a fog machine or cosmetic, so we don't have to worry about it when people inhale. What are the slide 39? What are the unintended consequences of these products? Well, first of all, there could be exposure to harmful chemicals we don't know about, the propylene glycol, as I mentioned, the nicotine toxicity, as I mentioned, from the way it's packaged. And one of the biggest questions is, are people going to go back and forth? And rather than quitting permanently, are they going to use these products, go back to cigarettes, use these products, are they going to use these products some days of the week and continue smoking because they think they've reduced their exposures overall? And could this entice former smokers to resume smoking? I mean, I think that all of these are important questions that should be asked. I mean, we certainly can't make conclusions either way today about the answers. I won't go through the data in detail, but there are now two published studies about these products, one from Tom Eisenberg's group, who basically gave a bunch of smokers these products, and what they found by looking at, and I'm on slide 40, plasma nicotine levels barely rise at all with the e-cigarettes while they do with their conventional brands. Carbon monoxide levels stay very low. But what, interestingly, in slide 41, is that even though the nicotine's not going up, there's obviously some placebo effect because the urges to smoke, craving, satisfaction is better than sham cigarettes when using the e-cigarettes. Not as, nearly as good as a regular cigarette, but something in between. You know, so one of the questions one could ask is that even if the nicotine doesn't come out and it's a lousy product, if this could be a substitute and there's no harm otherwise, for example, from the propylene glycol, maybe this is a better product. On slide 42, there's a data from one of the companies that produces these products, and they're basically showing the same thing. And what their claim is that the amount of nicotine that comes out of one of these products actually is similar, more similar to the Nicorette inhaler. And so, again, they're trying to liken themselves to a nicotine replacement therapy. So let me just take the last couple of minutes and talk about counseling patients to stop using smokeless tobacco. You know, the smokeless tobacco habit obviously happens from the nicotine addiction, and it's addiction more so. Even don't infer anything because I say habits here. It's really obviously an addiction. And I'm going to give you, I have a list here that you all can read later on ways to show signs of addiction. What do you want to do to try to get people to quit? I mean, obviously, you're going to utilize evidence-based treatments, and I have to tell you that it really mirrors smoking cessation counseling in many ways, or most ways. So that includes developing the intent to quit, getting them people to identify reasons, choosing a quit date, choose it carefully, experiment during that quitting. I mean, you all know how to do smoking cessation counseling better than I do, but trying to get people to understand what their cues are to use it, identify substitutes, whether it's sugar-free gum, sunflower seeds, or whatever, identify the triggers, try to avoid or delay acting on your cravings, and then on slide 45, implement that, you know, with a specific plan, and you all could read this quite well, and a lot of you are quite expert in smoking cessation counseling, but basically having a substitute for satisfying cravings, avoiding specific triggers, getting rid of all the smokeless tobacco. One thing that's particular here that might have some more benefit is advising people to get their teeth cleaned. Obviously avoiding smokeless tobacco using friends. As far as NRT, Chantix, that sort of thing, currently the FDA approval is not for these for not smokeless tobacco. Obviously, some people are using this off-label, but we really don't have the studies to say that they do, so therefore they are not approved by the FDA. and other quitting aids, you know, that have not been formally tested similarly for cigarettes, like hypnosis, acupuncture, and that sort of thing. So on slide 46, obviously when people have quit, they have to deal with their withdrawal symptoms according to their quit plan, and they need to have a plan for slips, just like with smoking. So 47 is reasons why people quit, maybe to help them think through why they should. There's a list here which comes from one of the NIH websites, and you can read this later as well. Nicotine withdrawal symptoms, obviously you want to prepare people for this. It's just like with smoking. Dizziness, depression, feeling of frustration, anxiety, irritability, etc. How do you respond to some of these things? On slide 49, obviously dealing with the urges and cravings, you know, they try to wait it out. Deep breathing, exercise is particularly helpful if they can. Feeling irritable, there's tense situations, trying to walk away from the situation, asking others to be patient with them, looking for help. Some of the issues with constipation irregularity, obviously adding fiber to the diet. Hunger and weight gain, like with smoking, is a particular problem. It's interesting because nicotine both decreases appetite as well as increases metabolism. So people get sort of a double whammy, and that's why they gain weight when they stop using nicotine. But if they can eat regular meals, smaller portions, do portion control, drinking lots of water, trying to increase their metabolism to physical activity, those are currently the best way to handle those. So let me just summarize here, and then we can take questions. So we talked about harm reduction strategies, which are integrated into the FDA legislation, but there's still very much a research question, and I think one really can make a specific recommendation to a patient around this. Smokeless tobacco is still considered not safe. As an alternative to smoking, it still remains a research question, especially on the impact on use and harm of tobacco and cigarettes. Snus does not appear to be worse than U.S. conventional smokeless tobacco and conceptually could be better, but the impacts on smokeless tobacco use and smoking needs to be evaluated. The e-cigs are drawing lots of media attention, and we have to be careful that that's what it is right now. There are no real studies on actual use, and it's a nicotine delivery device that really needs to be evaluated by FDA, and I think a lot of consumers out there just assume that it is. And it would be important to tell people that they don't know what they're using and they're made by some factory that's totally unregulated. And then obviously our mission in tobacco control is cessation of all tobacco products, and that's smokeless tobacco cessation counseling mimics smoking cessation counseling. And I'll stop there and take questions.
Okay. If you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, first in queue, we have Anne Morin. If you can please announce your organization, your line is open.
Hi, this is Laura Giardino. I'm listening with Anne, actually. I'm with the Suffolk County Department of Health Learn to Be Tobacco Free program. And I was just wondering what the general length of metabolized cotinine, how long does it last in the body?
Sure. Cotinine's half-life is only like 24 to 48 hours, so by a week it's pretty much all gone.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next in queue we have Leslie Omberg. If you can please announce your organization, your line is open.
Hello, I'm with the St. Joseph's Hospital Smoking Cessation Center in Syracuse, New York. Doctor, I was wondering if you know of any studies to establish a baseline for oral pharyngeal cancers so that we would know when there is a change, if there is one?
If I'm understanding your question, you were like, what would be the background rate of oral pharyngeal cancer if you weren't using tobacco products?
Yes, and then how long one anticipates before we would see a change?
Okay, good. So in the studies that look at oropharyngeal cancer, they compare it to people who are not smoking, and some of them are not smoking and not drinking. So those rates are available. I mean, I can't think of studies offhand, but multiple studies will have that information. Okay. So then the next question, which is a good question, is so if people were using snus versus smokeless tobacco, you know, how long would it take to see a difference? And for oropharyngeal cancer, I mean, it's going to take, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, I mean, as an estimate, and that's one of our problems with any of these harm-reducing products is if one were to use the criteria, how do we know they're successful for sure? The answer really only comes from an epidemiologic study that's going to take 20 or 30 years. And what do we do in the meantime, including all the changes in products and technology and that sort of thing? So what we hope to be able to do is to show changes with validated biomarkers of cancer risk, which we really don't have. Now, you know, you could use for smokeless tobacco some of the oral lesions that people get, and that you could see changes much sooner. But whether or not that translates to oral cancer risk, we don't know. But I would imagine that's where the studies would go first, because if you obviously don't see that sort of change, then you're not going to see a change in the cancer risk.
Thank you.
Okay. Next in queue, we have Charlene Dawn Barnett. Please announce your organization. Your line is open.
I'm from Wellness Education Services at the University of Buffalo in Buffalo, New York. I just had a question about how NRT and Chantix are not approved for use with smokeless tobacco. Is this because there just isn't enough research studies, or was there studies that showed it didn't help?
No, it's the former one, definitely.
Okay.
I mean, the FDA to approve it, someone's got to come to them with the studies, and I guess the pharmaceutical companies haven't thought that the market is big enough yet to fund enough of those studies.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Next in queue is Alicia Schneeberg. Please announce your organization. Your line is open.
Hello. This is Nassau County Mental Health, Chemical Dependency, and Developmental Disability Services. Just a quick question about, they say now that cigarettes are more addictive, and the reasoning they use is that they put more garbage into a cigarette, making it more addictive. So my curiosity is that these smokeless things are more nicotine-oriented. So is there like a psychological addiction versus a physical addiction to nicotine?
I'm trying to think of how to answer that question. It's obviously a multi-part thing. You know, cigarettes manufacturers today versus 30 years ago, you know, have lots of differences in cigarette ventilation, less so in terms of tobacco blend, but there are some differences. I guess what you're, maybe I'm not understanding what you're asking. Are you asking whether or not the newest snus products might be more addictive than the other ones, or is the issue for addiction of tobacco products oral, physical versus chemical?
Well, I was just thinking in terms of all these are geared towards making sure everybody gets, when you were talking about like certain things didn't work for them or the flavors didn't work for them and they moved on to other things, and then we're looking at this smokeless tobacco that now is employing the need to get the nicotine into the body. So I was just curious as to is it true advertisement that's really what is making a cigarette more addictive these days?
Okay, so that's really okay. That's the question. That's a very complicated question. you know, obviously, you know, as much as we know about this, okay, nicotine's driving the addiction, okay, but the tobacco companies they have a number of different ways of either enhancing the nicotine delivery. Or having other chemicals in there that increase the sensation to the nicotine. And so that is very much on their agenda about is how to make these things more addictive, more potent, and that sort of thing. And that is also true with the newest snus products. I mean, that's very much on their mind as they manipulate a number of different chemicals and pH and that sort of thing.
Okay, Dr. Shields, this is Annie Beigel. We have time for one more question.
Okay. Next in queue is Jean Bunch. If you can please announce your organization, your line is open.
I'm with the Nicotine Freeway Program at Choan Hospital in North Carolina. My question has been answered, actually, about the pharmaceutical use of nicotine replacement therapy and Chantix not being approved by FDA for smokeless tobacco because of the insufficient research. So my question has been asked and answered in that regard. So thank you.
Thank you very much, and that was the last question.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to, before we say goodbye to Dr. Shields and the participants, I'd like Pat Bax from the New York State Smokers Quitline to let you all know about some of the support that if your patients are using smokeless tobacco, they can receive at the New York State Smokers Quitline. Pat, you want to?
Yes, thank you, Annie, and thank you, Dr. Shields, for an excellent presentation. Thanks to all our participants today for joining our call. And for those of you who are new to the Quitline services, we are a free and confidential program. We provide evidence-based stop smoking services to all New York State residents who want to stop smoking or using other forms of tobacco. For tobacco users, they can call or click to quit, nysmokefree.com or 1-866-NY-QUITS. We offer free coaching and a starter kit of either patches, gum, or lozenges. And we do have an online smoke-free community for those that are interested in social media. For smokeless tobacco users, we usually receive about less than 1% of our clients that contact the Quit Line, but we do provide very tailored coaching and a separate interview to assist them in developing and implementing their quit plan. And you can also find a specific downloadable fact sheet that you can provide to your patients and your clients. It's on our website under Guides and Materials, and it addresses tips to stop using smokeless tobacco as well as other effective strategies. If you have specific questions, I do invite you to call the Quit Line directly at 1-866-697-8487, and our coaches will be happy to assist and answer any questions that you have for your smokeless tobacco users. Thank you very much, and Annie, I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, thanks, Pat. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, we'd like to sincerely thank you, Dr. Shields, for a very, very informative presentation today. And also thank all of you for participating on today's call. Please mark your calendars. Our next conference call will be on November 3rd. And we hope to be covering the topic of meaningful use of tobacco dependence treatment and chronic disease. So hold this date. We'll be sending out more information on this in a few weeks. And this brings us to the close of today's call. Thanks to all of you for participating, and have a great holiday weekend. Thank you.